Coming up next on Tech News Today, a Minnesota judge is asking Google to hand over the names of a bunch of people who ran a very specific search term on the search service. Advertisers pulled out of DoubleClick Ad Exchange when their ads appeared on top of hate videos on YouTube. Netflix moves to a thumbs up, thumbs down rating system. Mike Murphy from Quartz talks all about Nintendo's increase in production for the Nintendo Switch, and weaponizing animated GIFs on Twitter is bad for people who don't like going to jail. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1727, recorded Friday, March 17th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit.
And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TNT. Hello, welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories with people who are passionate about technology. Some of those people, new employees of Twit, as is the case with you. I'm Jason Howell, sitting with
Nathan Olivares-Giles. Thanks for having me here. I'm filling in for Megan today.
That's right. It's difficult to fill in for Megan, but yeah. I think you probably get the better end of the deal. Megan's moving right now and like packing and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know about you, but that stuff, I hate
it. It's not fun. I'm going to be doing that soon. I'm not really looking forward to that. So I got something I'm going to be working on here. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you here. We're going to talk about a whole lot of, today was one of those days where it was not difficult to find news stories. There's a lot going on. So we picked a few of our favorite stories, starting with this one. A Minnesota judge is ordering Google to determine and share the names of users who had searched for the name of a local fraud victim last December. The search leads to a photo, apparently, on Google that was used in a fraudulent passport that was then used to transfer $28,500 illegally from an Edina, Minnesota credit union. Google is being targeted alone because this same search apparently yields no results on other search engines, Bing, Yahoo. So I think the police and then the judge who is kind of enforcing this thinks, well, if it points to it on Google, the image exists there, it's what was used in this fraudulent case on the passport, then if we find the names of all the people who searched for that particular name, search that search term, then we're likely to find the person who perpetrated this.
Yeah, and I think you can understand the desire to want to use technology to narrow things down and find the bad guy here. But the information includes things like names, email addresses, payment info, MAC addresses, social security numbers, IPs. And this is just a ton of information that we're giving over to Google, to internet service providers, to all of these companies with a level of trust saying that this stuff isn't going to be shared. This is private data and private information. So whether or not Google complies with this is still an open question, right? But if it does, then we got to ask, okay, what are the implications going forward? Will it set some sort of precedent? And what does that mean for every Google user out there? And could that spread and set a precedent for other tech companies as well?
Yeah, right. I don't know if it's right to think of it like this, but I hate to say that at this point, I'm accustomed to seeing this sort of story, but associated with something on a national security level, something on a federal level. This ends up being a local municipality going out for a large grab of data based around like a search term. It's basically a big net. It's just saying everybody that happened to put in the search term, Google, you have to tell us all of the people who did that search term, and then we can do with that information what we feel like we need to do based on the judge's order. And I don't know why that feels different to me. Like, not that I think that it's okay like outright on a federal level, but the fact that it's on a state level makes it just I don't know. I feel like the impact, the potential impact is much greater there.
Yeah, and that's what kind of makes it feel like an overreach, and I think brings into question what these the consequences of this could mean for local authorities and just literally every single person in the United States. We actually did reach out to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and one of their criminal defense staff attorneys, Stephanie LaCambra, wrote back to us and said that this warrant is unusual in that it was approved without first establishing a threshold matter that the suspect perpetrator used Google to obtain the photo used in the fraudulent passport in the first place. So it really, you know, she's kind of speaking to the fact that this is broad. Mm-hmm. This might be a bit of an overreach. And it really does seem like the court here is just trying to get all the information it can and we'll make sense of it later. But that's not always the best approach when it comes to our private data.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. Stephanie, she sent us a lot. So thank you, Stephanie, for sending this to us. She kind of rounded things out by saying even worse than this invasion of privacy are the potential criminal justice consequences that would likely follow. Imagine a completely innocent party like the victim's neighbor, former high school classmate or ex-partner who had the misfortune of Googling the victim's name and would then be subject to law enforcement scrutiny and subsequent prosecution based on such circumstantial evidence. And that's like indicative of the big picture problem with something like this. You never actually truly know the intent behind a search term. And actually, this really reminds me of something we were talking about. I think it was just last week about how Google is using AI to kind of, you know, to flex its muscles in determining, you know, what should be surfaced higher than others, other things based on whether it's accurate, factual, that sort of stuff, kind of making these claims about this sort of stuff. You never truly know the intent of why someone is putting in a search term. Are they putting in that search term because they want to find, because they believe that this untruth actually happened, or are they putting in the search term because they know it's untrue and they want to see the source article for it for whatever reason? Same thing here. You don't know why someone puts that search term in there.
Yeah, it really seems like that level of broadness could lead to a lot of wasted time, a lot of wasted resources, a lot of wasted money, but also just get a lot of folks involved in these sorts of situations that don't need to be there in the first place. It's almost it almost feels like a guilty until proven innocent kind of idea, which is hopefully the total opposite of what our entire justice system should be based on.
So for sure.
Really, you want to be brought into this stuff. If there's a reason to include you, you shouldn't be included simply because, well, maybe we'll find a reason later.
Simply because you punched in the wrong combination of letters in the keyboard.
Exactly.
At the wrong time. Big brands are pulling their ads from Google's DoubleClick ad exchange service after it was shown that ads were being programmatically placed next to YouTube videos, or in fact, on top of YouTube videos promoting hate and racism. The UK government and The Guardian newspaper were the first to pull their ads after a Times of London article revealed the unfortunate pairing. That move led to a number of other big name advertisers following suit until they say guarantees are made by Google that this misplacement won't happen again. Google said in a blog post that it's working on changes to its reviews process to ensure ads appear where they should and not appear where they should not be. So I don't know how effective that's going to be when you consider... I don't know. Again, actually, this really reminds me of you know, what we were just talking about. Google is really trying to step it up to understand its content more so that it can hopefully prevent this sort of thing. We spoke about a story like a week and a half ago about how they're training their AI to actually analyze video content to a way that we've never done before, where it can look at video content, it can understand what is there, and you could see that totally being applied to something like this to help to make sure that their advertisers aren't stung by something like this.
Yeah, it's a really interesting situation, and you know, this is one of those situations where Google is admitting that it can't always get things right necessarily, but these things go hand in hand. You have to be able to trust the company with your data and with the research results they give you back to make the ads relevant and even worth buying, right? Mm-hmm. And if the advertisers can't trust that their ads are in the right places or not and associated with the correct content, then that ad money is going to go away. So this is really kind of foundational and core to what Google's actual business is, right? And that's leveraging your data and selling those ads. And so, you know, all of these things are happening in different parts of the company, but they all really go hand in hand. And just a couple days ago, we were talking about Google rolling out these Android accounts specifically built for children. Mm-hmm. And and taking those sorts of things into account. And you know, it's one thing to ask for an adult's data, but it's another thing to ask for your child's data and information. So I guess it makes sense that that Google would be reacting to this, given how important it is to their bottom line. You know, Google did also note that the removal of 2 billion offensive ads in 2016. So yep. I think they're trying to signal that, hey, you know, we're not caught off guard here. We know this is an issue. We're trying to do something about it. But very clearly, advertisers are speaking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you see that your ad is being layered on top of some of the videos that it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's pointed out to you and you didn't realize that was happening up until you see the video proof. I imagine that's quite an awakening right there. Yeah. I mean, Google's done a very good job, I think. Like you said, 2 billion offensive ads in 2016. That's nothing to sneeze at. There will always be things that get through the net. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's the unfortunate thing. But, you know. Google's working on it. Even Google admits they don't always get it right, which reminded me of their Beauty and the Beast thing from a couple of days ago, where they're like, you know what? We play around with things, and sometimes it doesn't work out.
Was that not an ad? I don't know.
Yeah. We don't always get it right. Yeah. But I'm convinced they're working on it. They certainly have a financial incentive, too.
It also just feels like, you know, given how long Google's been at this, though, that they really should have these things nailed by this point. I don't know if that's unfair to say or not, but... this is what Google does, you know? So it's like at some point, you know, YouTube isn't old. They're not a startup anymore. And, right. and kind of having these things together and a better response is what you'd expect. So, you know, these are recurring issues. And I know as our technology grows, new problems pop up. But, you know, how many passes should they get for this sort of thing?
How do they do that on YouTube? Like YouTube, the amount of video that's uploaded every second.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just there's no way that they could possibly staff enough people to actually have human eyeballs on this stuff to be able to make those determinations.
And that's where the importance of AI is really going to just be heightened in the future, right? They're going to be relying on software, on machines to be analyzing those things and to be their eyes and ears and to flag things for them.
Right.
And that's
it's
when you might
flagging
bring
and
being,
reporting
right?
by users
but
as
we've,
well.
We've seen that. We've seen that be a problem in the past where, you know, we've seen, you know, racist search results and things like this, you know, animals coming up when you're looking for specific ethnic groups and human beings and all sorts of things. So obviously the AI needs some work and it's not ready to be used in all these senses, but that's really got to be the answer for Google as these things scale
really
and grow, because you'll never have enough human power to do all that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Living in the San Francisco area is not cheap, even for well-paid tech employees. That's why Zapier, a San Francisco-founded startup made up of 80 remote working employees, is offering a delocation package. It's offering employees up to $10,000 in reimbursement expenses to leave the Bay Area and move somewhere else. Now, in order to get the reimbursement, the employees have to commit to working for Zapier for at least 1 year. Now, this is a pretty fascinating story that was reported by Inc. magazine. And in a blog post, Zapier said that employees shouldn't have to sacrifice their career just to live comfortably or do things like start a family, buy a home, all these sorts of things. So they're really encouraging folks to get out of the Bay Area and work abroad. Pretty fascinating.
I mean, the reality is, you know, based on... You know, when you're working in the computer industry and the technology industry, you don't have to. I mean, there's like this myth, there's this feeling that is always out there that you have to be in the major metropolitan areas that, you know, tech is known for. Silicon Valley,
yep.
New York, LA. You know, there's certain hubs
yeah.
that you have to be. The reality is, though, like, why? Like, so much of what we do, you don't have to be on site for that.
Yeah.
I guess that makes sense.
Well, yeah. And there are a few companies that are really taking this kind of working remotely to heart and making it core to what their company is. And Zapier is one of them. Automatic, the company behind WordPress, does the same thing and having all remote employees.
Full disclosure, they are a sponsor on the network.
Thanks for pointing that out. Yeah. But yeah, basically what Zapier said in this blog post announcing this deal for their employees is that when they started the company, they basically were started out of Y Combinator. They came to San Francisco because it was just a couple of guys, and that's where the resources were at the time, right? Very early on, they found some employees in Colombia and they found some employees in other parts of the United States, and they went with this work remotely model, and it's kind of worked for them. Now, so far, this has only applied to San Francisco employees, but they did make it clear in this blog post that they – are open to experimenting with other markets if the San Francisco deal is a success, mm-hmm. Because there are definitely other places like New York, like Los Angeles, that might be cost prohibitive for folks. And you know, even other bubbling tech scenes like Austin might be a good choice.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, we'll see where this all goes. But what isn't made clear in the Inc. story or in the blog post is whether or not the San Francisco employees will be able to take those San Francisco salaries with them as they move. But that brought up a question to me as to, you know, just how much are these folks making? Because as the cost of living and the housing demand goes up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and, you know, we're going to have Uber moving into Oakland pretty soon. That's mm-hmm. that's leading to a lot of talk of gentrification and rising rent prices.
Sure.
It just gets tougher and tougher. And what was a good San Francisco salary a few years ago might look a little different, you know, depending on how the housing market looks.
And if you're working for a company and living in San Francisco, you're accustomed to a certain level. If a company wants to give you $10,000 bonus, it's nothing to, you know, $10,000 reimbursement for moving expenses or whatever, that's nothing to sneeze at.
Mm-hmm.
But if that is also in concert with, well, yeah, but you're living in small town, you know, wherever, and we don't need to pay you the same, that might be a different situation entirely.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how I'd feel about that.
You're probably not.
Like, I want it all.
Yeah. Probably not going to get to enjoy the free lunch and snacks that you might have at another store.
Yeah, no more Cheetos. You're going to have to buy those Cheetos. You can do that with $10,000 now. Netflix is moving on from its star rating system for users and towards the simpler method of thumbs up, thumbs down. After extensive user testing, the thumbs received 200% more ratings from users, fueling Netflix's recommendations engine that they are very proud of, by the way. Speaking of recommendations, Netflix is also rolling out a percent match feature that shows users when a show or a movie on the network or on the service is more than 50% of a match to their taste. So they're basically putting a numerical value to it so you can see, oh, 98% match. I'm probably really going to like that based on Netflix's algorithms. If it's below 50%, you just won't see it. So if you don't see that number, you probably don't want to touch it.
Yeah, this is fascinating to me because I get it. Like, the thumbs up is a lot more simple, right?
Yes.
And that's probably why you see the higher engagement. That's probably why people are using the thumbs up more than they are using the five-star system. But at the same time, it's a lot less accurate. It's a lot less detailed. There's a difference between when I give something 4 stars versus 5 stars or 3 stars versus 5 stars. But thumbs up versus thumbs down, that's a lot broader, right?
Yeah.
So now they bring in this percentage, and that's a little, you know, it's going to take time to really understand what that means for each Netflix user. And, you know, one of the things that makes Netflix so great is how good the recommendation engine really is.
Yeah, I would agree.
You can get in there, you can get started real quick. You don't have to really have very many questions as to if you're going to like things or not. And so now here's this new factor. So I can't wait to try it out, but it really sounds like this could either be great or it could be a total failure and much worse than the existing system.
Well, and Netflix,
it could go either way, right?
It could go either way. Netflix did point out that you know, the star rating system was super supported by users early on. It was super popular for a while, and then it slowly over time just users stopped really contributing to it. I know for myself, like I used to star rate everything. And now, like, I couldn't even be bothered to do it. I just want to watch my stuff, whatever. I don't care. There's the thing I want to watch. Great. I watched it, move on with my life. I don't know what that means about me, but they said that basically that's only one piece of the puzzle, that they actually gain a lot more than that at just analyzing behavior. What do you watch? How far into things do you watch?
Did you complete a show or not?
Did you complete the series in like 2 days? You probably really liked it.
Yeah, did you binge on it? Did it take you a few months?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I would guess that maybe that behavior combined with a thumb up is going to give them just an extra data point, mm-hmm, but they're already learning so much about you. And like you say, they do a really good job with the recommendations.
They do. You know, I guess maybe one of the reasons why I like the star system so much is I'm one of the probably very few people who sits there on my couch and is like, God, was this a 4 star? Or was this a 5 star? I really liked it. You know, Daredevil season 1 was definitely 5, but Daredevil season 2, that was a 4, you know? And then, like, most people are probably just skipping that and not doing that. So I might not be reflective of the overall user base here.
Right. Yeah. I think at one point, like when I started kind of getting a little overwhelmed by it, I basically forced myself to do like a 1, 3, and 5. I was like, I feel impartial? It's a 3. Do I like it? It's a 5. Do
no
I not? It's a 1. No in-betweens. Just simplify it for myself.
I like that streamlined approach. This is good. This is really good. Awesome. Well, Chance the Rapper made history earlier this year as the first artist to win a Grammy for a streaming-only album. You couldn't buy a physical copy of it. Now, Chance the Rapper is going public with the business deal he made with Apple on that very record. In a series of tweets published Friday, Chance said that Apple paid him $500,000 for 2 weeks of streaming exclusivity for the record Coloring Book. Apple also featured Chance in an ad. This is the first time an artist has been so transparent with the terms of a music deal made with Apple. And that makes me wonder, why talk so openly on Twitter about this very issue?
This is where I go, I'm old. I've heard of Chance the Rapper. I probably could not tell you whether I've heard any of his songs. I'm sure they're awesome. I love the fact that he went alone. I think that's awesome from an artist standpoint. That really speaks to where we're at this point in time for kind of self-directed careers in music and everything. I love seeing that. I have to imagine, and this goes for a lot of creatives right now, digital creatives surviving on the internet, is that a large part of the reason that they are so successful is because they're very open and candid with their followers, with their fan base, with the people that are really excited about the work that they're doing. So this, you know, it sounds like there was some blowback from fans on that exclusivity, and apparently this is his way of being like, look, I'm still being real here.
Yep.
I'm going to be real with you and share with you what was in it for me. What I don't understand is whether Apple actually had any sort of an NDA on revealing that information. I have to imagine Apple would that's a very important information that Apple would want to be kept secret, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, knowing how much Chance the Rapper makes, and for those who don't know, in hip hop right now, he's, you know, one of the most popular rappers out there. Now Drake, you know, might be like the household name. It's
right,
popular
totally.
With like all of your teenage household cousins name. And all yep. that good stuff. Everybody knows who he is. But Chance the Rapper isn't quite at that level, but he's really well known. And he actually, like you just said, made his name on the internet, sharing stuff on SoundCloud, sharing stuff on Instagram, sharing stuff on a mixtape website called Dat Piff. So if you're into hip hop and you're into basically discovering new music, he made all the things he did widely available to you. And he gave you a little bit of a sneak peek behind his process from time to time as well.
Yep.
Even showing you, you know, different versions of songs and how things would progress. So this would kind of fall lock in step with that. But of course, you know, when Apple's making a deal with Chance the Rapper, if another rapper of the same stature or level, or just musician in general, isn't getting the same exclusivity deal, that's when things could get awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, he just won a Grammy. So is this, you know, to kind of juice up the negotiations on that next album? Because obviously the guy's going to deserve a little bit more now that he's, you know, made some history, definitely a bigger name than he was a year ago. So there's a lot of, you know, business factors that are at play here. But one of the things that Chance mentioned on Twitter was that people were questioning his independence. And he did note that, hey, after that 2 week window went away, this is why I put it on SoundCloud for free and everyone could listen to it. So he definitely takes an unorthodox route, definitely an advocate for musicians to go out on their own and not sign with record labels, which is what he's done. But of course, not everybody is Chance. Now, in 2015, it was reported that Drake received more than $19 million to host a weekly show on Beats One, Apple's streaming radio station inside of their Apple Music app, as well as some music exclusivity. And so the gulf between Drake at $19 million and Chance at $500,000.
A little bit of difference between those two figures.
A little bit of
figures.
A Grand Canyon there. But
one was a little bit more employment, though, also.
You know that's a good point.
There's a little bit of an extra recurring kind of responsibility from Drake for that $19
million. That is a good point. But, you know, I do wonder, is it better for Apple to kind of piecemeal out all these deals to different artists, whether they're signed to labels or not? Or should they really just spend, you know, a couple billion and go buy Tidal or Spotify or something like that?
What would they get if they bought Tidal or Spotify? I mean, especially now that they have, I mean, they already have their own service. They're kind of very similar. Is that just reducing competition, taking one of the big ones out?
Reducing competition and just kind of blowing up that user base in a jump, right? So part of the reason why Apple might want exclusivity with someone like Chance the Rapper and someone like Drake or whoever else would be to get people to flock to their service. If I have some kind of album here that you can't hear anywhere else, an exclusive music video, whatever, then you're going to come to me. Now, that doesn't always actually show up in the user numbers. That's Tidal's big selling point. Mm-hmm. A lot of musicians and artists are actually part owners of the service, including Jay-Z and Madonna and lots of others.
They get a 3% stake. As incentive for those exclusives.
Exactly. But Tidal isn't necessarily at the level of challenging Spotify or Apple. Now, if Apple bought Tidal, you could presume that they would take over all those exclusive rights deals and things like that. But, you know, Apple so far seems to be happy with its course of working out these piecemeal deals and just kind of building its own service. And, you know, the numbers are growing and it seems to be working out for them.
Absolutely.
All right, well, up next, we're going to talk about the Nintendo Switch. But first, let's take a minute to thank Grasshopper, the sponsor of this episode. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. It works just like a traditional phone system, but it requires no hardware to purchase. With their iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper also allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client will see the Grasshopper caller ID, so they'll see the name of your business instead of your personal phone number. Simply select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, and add multiple extensions for your business. Toll-free numbers are a great tool for marketing, and they can make your business sound more professional. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. Get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. You can also send and receive SMS and text messages from your business number. Join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month. You have a 30-day money-back guarantee. Turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. And we thank Grasshopper for their support. Now, it looks like the Nintendo Switch is going to be just as popular as the Wii so far. But the Switch has reportedly sold about 1.5 million units through its first week, slightly edging out sales of the Wii, Nintendo's last hit console. Now, Nintendo is reportedly doubling its production levels to meet consumer demand. Mike Murphy from Quartz wrote a story on this today. Mike, is it safe to say that the Switch won't be a dud like the Wii U at this point?
Hey, how's it going? Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, if these rates keep up and Nintendo only makes just the number of cartridges it looks or consoles it looks like they're going to, it would outsell the Wii U in a year, which is kind of insane. But you know, I mean, initial kind of pops are one thing versus, you know, being able to drive sales over years. And you know, one of the big problems right now is that unless you're a really big Zelda fan, there's really not a lot to play. I haven't really touched my Switch, and I'm looking at it right now. It's just sitting there very forlorn. I haven't really touched it in like a week because I suck at Zelda.
Oh, I was gonna say because you already solved Zelda.
I'm so mad, do I
go for a victory run? Nah, save that for another time. Well, I mean, how important has the Switch's success been to Zelda? It's almost like I feel like the success story of the Switch is equal parts Switch and equal parts, wow, Zelda's a great game. Even though Zelda is on a different console, it's not exclusive to the Switch, but it's a big driver for it, right?
Yeah, I completely agree. There's nobody's going out buying a Wii U just for this, so there'd be no reason because you could just buy the Switch for about the same money. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. This is the Zelda game. I'm really bad at it, but it's clear how beautiful a game it is, how awesome it is. It's definitely as good as the last one I remember being good at, which was the Ocarina of Time 20 years ago. But yeah, I mean, unless you really want that, I mean, it's that makes it essentially the, you know, the console costs $300 and the game costs $50. So unless you really want to spend $350 on a very good game, which is a really hard justification, you know, I think it's tough to see sales right now continuing at the level they have. That being said, you know, Mario Kart comes out in 2 or 3 weeks and that'll be huge. I will play the heck out of that. And then, you know, over the course of the year, there's going to be all kinds of new games.
So what sort of games do you think Nintendo has to deliver to justify doubling its production levels at this point? Obviously Mario Kart's going to come, but they need to keep those sorts of things coming. From my perspective, I love Zelda. I've put in like 50 hours, but there's a ton of indie games that are showing up that aren't necessarily household names the way that Mario Kart is, and then Mario Odyssey, which is probably not going to come until maybe around like Thanksgiving.
I think, yeah, the indie games could definitely be a big thing. I mean, there was a couple of games, Shovel Knight games that were pretty big. I haven't played them yet, but I know that they're really popular with a certain sect of gamers. But, you know, you were just showing 1-2 Switch, which is one of the other launch titles, which, in my opinion, is one of the biggest stumbling blocks of this whole launch. That, you know, if you remember the Wii U, what was so amazing about it was the fact that you had this new way of controlling games. You could play with your hands and kind of feel like you were actually playing games. And that was highlighted in the launch game of Wii Sports, which came bundled with most of the consoles that were sold originally. And it was awesome. Everybody loved it. Everyone loved bowling, like a little, you know, a little tiny version of yourself bowling and or playing baseball or tennis or whatever. But the game that Nintendo chose to show off the Switch's similar capabilities, you know, you can pretend to be firing a gun, you can pretend to be milking a cow and stuff. What's so strange to me about this is not only is it not free, it costs $50, which is a lot of money for this sort of game. There's not actually a game. I mean, if you look at the screen of what's going on right now, they're not actually interacting with the console. They're just looking at each other and feeling some sort of weird vibration in their hand. It's like, how is this worth $50? I'm just looking at odd videos and whoever, you know, like my roommate or whoever I'm playing the game against. And it just, it doesn't feel anywhere near as fun or as like, you know, it's like kooky and it's like maybe for once. But I there was no review copies of that game. And for me, you know, I actually went out and bought it. I'm like, this is the worst $50 I've spent in a really long time. And I buy a lot of dumb stuff. I'm wearing AirPods. and, you know, for me, that is a huge problem. And what I'm driving at here is like, these are the sorts of games that Nintendo needs. They need fun, interactive games that are different than, you know, the reason you pick up an Xbox or a PlayStation or PC games. Like, you pick up a Nintendo because, you know, they have their own IP, which is great, and there's a lot of nostalgia attached to it, but you pick them up because they're a lot of fun and they're engaging. Right. And to me, the Switch really, or 1-2 Switch really isn't that. And Zelda's great, but we need more games. You know, Mario Kart has a little bit. You can play driving style, but we need like more interactive, different games that are actually going to be like original IP or indie IP. It's like actually going to be worth buying and playing this system in the future.
Yeah, it's kind of what I was curious about is that if expectations are being set so high based on the initial launch and the excitement that's around it right now, does that make it even more challenging for Nintendo to kind of prove itself in the long run? And it sounds like what you're saying is the quality of its in-house games is going to drive it the way Nintendo in-house games have always driven their consoles. Like their success, whether they want to, you know, admit it or not, is largely dependent on the quality of their in-house made titles.
Yeah, they've never quite brought in third-party developers the way that they should. And part of it is their consoles are generally a lot less powerful than what's coming from Microsoft and Sony. So when you have big audiences over there, if you're going to make that new Call of Duty shooter, you're going to make that Madden game, you're going to start with that higher quality and, frankly, bigger audience. And then you think about Nintendo after the point. So I think, you know, if they can do something, you know, throw in 1-2 Switch as a free game and then bring back something like Wii Sports, bring back something that does bring people together, that taps in. And hey, you still got a little bit of nostalgia from, you know, that console existing because we all had it and loved it. So bring those sorts of things back. And, you know, but will that be enough to make up for that gulf in those third parties is always a question because, you know, well, I'm going to buy all of these Nintendo systems, even though I felt like I got burned buying the Wii U because, frankly, there weren't enough games to play. You know, guys like me, you know, men and women like me, that audience is going to dwindle if you don't have those quality games. There's only so many passes you're going to give Nintendo. So it's kind of encouraging to see that the hardware is so great, that Zelda's so great. But now it's like, can they live up to that hype? And I don't know, Mike, do you have any insight as to this, whether or not this hype could be a double-edged sword for them if there's delays in games like, say, Mario Kart or Mario Odyssey? Because Nintendo has had a problem with delaying games in the past as well.
Yeah, I think that could definitely hurt them. That being said, I think one thing to consider with the Switch that might actually save them is, you know, there are other games that might be coming. I think Minecraft is a great example of that. Like, that is something that could be so perfect for younger kids who maybe had it on an iPad and it's kind of fun, but, you know, being able to play it on the big screen and then play it in the back of the car while they're on the way to like school or something like that, and always being able to play in their spare time could be huge if they can, you know, kind of deliver on the way you actually play the game. You know, that could make up for any potential delays or kind of shortcomings of things like Mario Odyssey or any other coming games. You know, at the end of the day, it's there's a lot of people like, you know, in their 20s and 30s who remember and older who remember Nintendo consoles and are buying them because of what they were. But there's so many kids that are, you know, they never had a SNES or an N64. This is their first experience with Nintendo. So a lot of this stuff will seem exciting and new and different just because, you know, the Wii U was terrible and a 10-year-old wasn't alive in 2006 when the Wii came out. So, you know, there's definitely an audience of kids, especially at Christmas time, who are going to be like, this thing is so crazy and different. Please buy me it.
And there'll be a decent library at that point with which to push people in that direction. Before we let you go, I thought you mentioned Ocarina of Time. I put a link in the doc. I don't know if you saw it, Anthony, right underneath the Quartz article while we've been doing this interview. Kevin, who edits the show, gave us a link to a video of a friend of his friend. So he doesn't know this person, but apparently someone worked their Amazon Echo into a device that will actually take musical cues from the Ocarina of Time in order to do things in the home. Like turn on the lights, unlock the doors, all based on what he plays with a mystical pan flute. Maybe it's it's a Raspberry Pi, so it's not an Echo. So there you go. This is what we could all aspire to.
That is a level of just passion and nerdiness that I can only dream of reaching someday. That is the most hardcore Zelda. I thought I was a hardcore Zelda fan. That is the most hardcore Zelda fan thing I've seen in quite a while.
I guess the challenge there is you got to bring your flute with you everywhere you go around the home. Here you go. Here you go. Sun Song. Yes, lights are on. Anyways, it's a good video. Definitely check it out. It's on the YouTube channel, Sufficiently Advanced.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Mike. Tell people where they can find you online.
I'm always on Twitter, which is MCWM, and otherwise QZ.com. That's where all my stories live.
Right on. Mike, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you feel better. I know you're sick today, so thanks for taking time, even though you're not feeling well.
Appreciate it.
Have a good night and go to sleep. All right, Michael from New York City wrote into TNT at twit.tv to say, regarding the Google ad for Beauty and the Beast, it reminded me of product placement in TV shows. Companies pay big bucks to have their product used in a TV show, and no one ever says, oh, by the way, that character using a MacBook is basically an ad. Well, to which I would say, well, some people do. Some people say that. Some people say, hey, that's so blatantly obvious that that was product placement. But
yeah, I was just watching the recent comedy horror film Get Out with some friends.
Oh, man, I want to see that.
It's so good.
That's all I hear.
So good. But every character in it is using a Windows phone, like a brand new Windows phone running Windows 10. And I've yet to see a single person out in the real world using one of those. And hey, obviously, like being a tech journalist, it stands out to me in ways that it might not to other people.
Right.
But every time I saw it, I was just like, that's not real.
Like this reality is being shattered right now. This is not real.
It just gets me every single time.
Yeah. Nice. All right. Well, one of these days I'll watch that movie. Maybe when my kids are older, apparently, because I don't go to the movies anymore. That's what happens when you become a parent. Fair warning. Up next, it's possible to weaponize Twitter, apparently. But first, let's take a minute to thank Blue Apron. They're the sponsor of this episode. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. It's going to make you a better cook. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals for less than $10 per person. Every meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card. You can go ahead and file that away when you're done and make it another time. Also, pre-portioned ingredients included in the box that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Not all ingredients, of course, are created equal, so it's important to know where your food comes from, to be educated on that. Blue Apron actually sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the U.S. Seafood sourced sustainably. Beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals. Produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. And by shipping the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, Blue Apron is reducing food waste. You get exactly what you need for your recipe. You use it all. It makes making the recipe a heck of a lot easier, too. Their freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental U.S. There's no weekly commitment. So you'll only get deliveries when you want them. You can customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences. You just go online and you can choose from a variety of new recipes every week. Got a little selection there. Or you can just let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you and keep it fresh. Recipes are not repeated within a year either, so you'll never get bored. So just a few ideas here. Salmon piccata with orzo and broccoli. There's pork chops and miso butter with bok choy and marinated apple. Vegetable chili and baked sweet potatoes with crispy tortilla strips. And finally, spicy shrimp coconut curry with cabbage and rice. Imagine a box that arrives with all the ingredients you need to make all those four recipes, and you have an idea of what Blue Apron is all about. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TNT. And you'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/TNT and find a better way to cook with Blue Apron.
Every time you do that ad, I just get...
That's the problem. You get to the part where you're reading the food and you're just like, okay, I'm doing a show? I'd rather be eating right now, apparently.
It's tough. It's tough. All right. TNT's fan of the day is Geek.O on Twitter, who sent us this picture saying he watches TNT with hot tea and a Khaleesi kitty in the man cave / office. Now, I love this picture. He's got a collector's edition of Zelda. I can see that in the corner over to the left, right by his entertainment center. It looks like he's got an Xbox controller there. Lots of Batman and Superman figurines, some comics. Like, this is a cool room.
This is the epitome of man cave here.
Yeah. I guess I see a Nintendo Classic there on the right, too. I mean, he's got a lot of good stuff.
Too shabby. But you didn't point out the most important thing.
Which is?
He's got us.
Oh, yeah. We're there up on you the go. Wall.
We're up on the wall. There we are. All three of us from Wednesday's show.
I was like the TIE fighter in the right corner. Is that what you're talking about?
Oh, you're right. I totally missed the TIE fighter. You're totally right, Jason.
No, yeah. Thanks for watching Geek.O. That is a beautiful place to be watching anything. And thanks for watching us. Really appreciate that. Anyways, show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it to Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we're going to find it.
Yeah, that's right. We'll look for it. We'll try and find it anyways. I need to go diving again, but we've got tons, and we appreciate it. Keep sending them. All right, finally, here's something I never really considered before today. In retrospect, I guess, yeah, it's obvious that it would be possible. I just never considered it. Apparently, it's entirely possible to weaponize animated GIFs on Twitter. Kurt Eichenwald is a journalist who writes for Newsweek and Vanity Fair, and Kurt is epileptic, something he's written about extensively in the past. Shortly after appearing on TV last December, where apparently he criticized Donald Trump's agenda for the White House transition in a very public sense in video form, a Twitter user tweeted Eichenwald an animated GIF of a strobing effect with a message that read, quote, "You deserve a seizure." Which happened as a result, apparently. And I guess since then, he worked alongside the FBI. Today, he tweeted out that the man who sent the tweet had been located, apprehended, and is now facing charges as a result. This just kind of blew my mind. Like, I never thought that would be possible, but I guess so.
Yeah, when we saw this come up and we were talking about it, just the idea that, you know, trolling can actually trigger a seizure with someone. Essentially online harassment in this way is a pretty fascinating but also pretty frightening idea.
Yeah.
I mean, just scrolling through the at mentions that you have, you wouldn't even have to read a tweet to have that trigger. And the fact that there were so many people, how many people sent him this gift?
Another 40 people, he said, in that Twitter thread. And he said that they are possibly being sought for this too.
Yeah. Yeah. But it also just shows how the things that you do online, even if you think they're anonymous, even if you think that you're hiding behind some username and a funny little picture or something, they can be tracked. And mm-hmm. and sometimes they have real world consequences. And when you're triggering, when you're giving someone a seizure, the idea that could be a form of attack, or, you know, I don't know. We don't know what the charges are, but right. You know, was it assault, or who knows what it was?
I think they're going to release that in the next coming days, next few days.
But it's just a fascinating story all the way around. Now, Twitter has had an ongoing harassment and troll problem for years now. It's something that they've spoken pretty openly about, and something that myself and lots of other journalists have covered over the years quite extensively. But yeah, I have never heard of anything quite like this.
Yeah, and I mean, it, on one hand, I read about this and I was like, well, okay, so that makes sense. On the other hand, like you say, we've heard of a lot of really bad, nasty stuff happening on Twitter. Threats, life, you know, threats for people's lives, a whole lot of, you know, threats against women, you know, really nasty stuff. And I don't know where to fall down on this, where I'm like, okay, well, then how come this happened for him, but it doesn't happen for others? And, you know, extending that out, is that the internet that we want, where, well, I don't know. I mean, if it's affecting people's livelihood and it's threatening their health, then yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
You want you want there to be some sort of line in the sand that says, this is not right. Don't do this.
Yeah. And, you know, that's part of what has made trolling such a problem for social networks like Twitter.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, you can say and do something online, but if it doesn't have a real world tangible effect, you know, what is there to prosecute, right? What is there to go after? What did you really do wrong? Right. So I guess that might be the threshold is, this is something that had a consequence for this man that didn't just exist online. It actually triggered seizures for him. So in the same way that maybe if you make a threat to someone online, you know, like if, you know, and then you actually show up in person and then do that, follow through on that.
Right.
Now, of course, you got to wonder if all of the people who sent this GIF really understood the full ramification of what they were doing. But, you know, if the consequence is real, you don't necessarily get a pass for that. So, it's an open question to see whether or not this was followed through on because he's a journalist, because he might be someone not quite a public figure,
but that's
kind of in
question,
that realm
actually.
And area. I mean, not everybody will necessarily have the resources or even maybe the wherewithal to even contact authorities and to take that next step. But, you know, we'll have to see where this all goes.
Yeah, I'm sure that aspect helped a little bit, you know, having been on TV prior. And
I think it might.
You know, he's got a megaphone just built into his career. So whether that's good or bad, there you go. Nate, this was a lot of fun.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you're not going anywhere. You're here all next week. And I think even the following Monday and Tuesday, because I'm out next week.
Yes.
Megan's back, so you'll be doing the show with Megan.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, but you're going to have to suffer with me a little bit more. but yeah, I'll be filling in for you while you're out on a little vacation. And, you know, I'm excited. I'm just getting started here at Twit. Looking forward to learning and growing a lot with everyone. And hopefully, you know, within the next week, my teleprompter skills will be that much better.
You did great.
We'll see. But no, this feels really good. And I feel at home on the show. And I'm excited to fill in.
Awesome. Appreciate it. Although you'll have to get used to sitting over here because I don't think Megan's given up that seat.
Hey, I'll sit anywhere you want to put me, man. All good.
Sounds good. TNT records live every Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW, and you can find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV.
Find all the ways to subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to see us in person, please do. We'd love to have a live audience. Just email tickets@twit.tv. And if you want to tweet me, I'm at Nate OG.
Nate OG. And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Anthony, of course. Thanks to Mario for helping out here in the studio. Thanks to Kevin for editing the show. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today and all week. We'll see y'all on Monday. Have a great weekend. Bye, everybody. You want to do the high five? Yes?
Yeah. High five. All right. There it goes.